This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, November 8th, 2006. From the Capitol Hill Bureau in Washington, D.C., I'm Ingrid Drake, sitting in for Aura Bagado.
After a series of thoughtful conversations, Secretary Rumsfeld and I agreed that the timing is right for new leadership at the Pentagon.
In today's newscast, Bush names former CIA director to take over the Pentagon, more than 20 people killed in Israeli airstrikes, and new challenges to the government of Oaxaca. We'll have those stories and more, but first, the news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Leftist leader Daniel Ortega claimed victory last night in Nicaragua's presidential elections. Ortega says his government will fight poverty and strive towards reconciliation of the country's divided society. Joe Replico reports from Managua.
With 92% of votes counted last night, Ortega held a 9-point lead over his nearest opponent, right-wing banker Eduardo Montalegre. That's enough to win him the presidency. After the results were announced, Montalegre showed up at the headquarters of Ortega's Sandinista National Liberation Front, or FSLN party, to congratulate the new president. Ortega first came to power in 1979 at the head of the Sandinista revolutionaries who overthrew dictator Anastasio Somoza. He then served as elected president from 1985 to 1990, when he was defeated by anti-Sandinista candidate Violeta Chamorro. Ortega was also defeated in the last two presidential elections, in 1996 and 2001. This year's election became a battleground between Washington conservatives, who see Ortega as a danger to democracy and free trade, and Hugo Chavez, who openly backed Ortega's campaign. But the former Marxist revolutionary says he's become more moderate. In his speech last night, Ortega said he would keep the country open to investment and work with his opponents. He said fighting poverty, faced by the majority of Nicaraguans, would be his main objective. Jill Replogle, FSRN, Managua.
A Chilean Supreme Court justice has concluded hearings in the extradition case against Peru's former president, Alberto Fujimori. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has more.
Fujimori, who ruled Peru from 1990 to 2000, is wanted on 12 charges that include human rights violations and corruption. Among the human rights charges Fujimori faces is a notorious 1991 massacre in the Lima neighborhood of Barrios Altos, where 15 people were killed, and the 1992 murder of 9 students and a professor at the University of La Cantuta. Also included in the 12 charges is the embezzlement of some $15 million from public coffers. As Fujimori marked 1 year in Chile yesterday, the local chapter of Amnesty International reminded Chilean authorities of their obligation, according to international law, to extradite Fujimori to Peru so he can be tried there. Court officials say the ruling is expected by the end of December. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Officials from Washington, D.C. are in East Asia this week to discuss strategies with allies prior to nuclear negotiations with North Korea. Jason Strother has the latest from Seoul.
The U.S. and South Korea will not recognize North Korea as a nuclear power. The announcement was made following a meeting between top American envoys and the South Korean Foreign Ministry. U.S. Undersecretaries of State Nicholas Burns and Robert Joseph arrived on the peninsula after talks with officials in Japan. Tokyo has also indicated that it will not grant the reclusive state nuclear status. Pyongyang's detonation of an atomic device on October 9th may have been an attempt to raise its bargaining leverage once the six-country negotiations get back underway after a year-long deadlock. Chinese state media reported that President Hu Jintao will meet with President Bush and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on the sidelines of the upcoming APEC summit in Vietnam. How to persuade Kim Jong-il to give up his nukes is expected to be on their agenda. There is still no set date for the resumption of multilateral talks that include the U.S., both Koreas, China, Japan, and Russia. Officials are hopeful that the new round will begin before the end of this year. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
Voters in several states reported a number of problems during yesterday's elections. New electronic voting machines caused delays or confusion amongst poll workers and voters in Ohio, Florida, Georgia, Kansas, Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Illinois. Long lines at the polls also prompted judges in Colorado, Ohio, and Indiana to extend hours at the voting booths. Changes in rules regarding the identification necessary to cast a ballot also caused widespread problems in multiple states. And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
After the largest armed services newspaper chain recently published an editorial calling for Rumsfeld's resignation, combined with years of activist organizing and pressure from Democratic Representative Nancy Pelosi, the next House Majority Leader, President Bush today announced Rumsfeld's resignation as Defense Secretary.
I have been talking with Don Rumsfeld over a period of time about fresh perspective. He likes to call it fresh eyes. He himself understands that Iraq is not working well enough, fast enough. And he and I are constantly assessing, and I'm assessing as well all the time by myself about, do we have the right people in the right place? Are we at the right strategy? As you know, we're constantly changing tactics, and that requires constant assessment. And so he and I both agreed in our meeting yesterday that it was appropriate that I accept his resignation. And so the decision was made. Actually, I thought we were going to do fine yesterday.
To replace Rumsfeld, Bush named Robert Gates, who served as CIA director under Bush Sr. The nomination of Gates, who was cleared of criminal charges in the Iran-Contra affair, must be confirmed by the Senate, which may challenge if the intelligence insider, who critics say did not predict the fall of the Soviet Union, is qualified to lead the biggest federal agency. Stacey Hafley is the head of Military Families Speak Out Midwest. She is traveling to the Pentagon tomorrow to deliver Rumsfeld a petition calling for an end to the backdoor draft and to bring the troops home now. And they want to make sure that the incoming Secretary of Defense gets the same message.
We absolutely are thrilled that this is happening, although we want to make sure that the focus of the new Secretary of Defense is going to make the changes appropriately to end the war and bring the troops home. We want to make sure that that is his top priority, that he understands that just because Rumsfeld's gone doesn't mean that we are not going to continue to ask for these troops to be brought home immediately.
During yesterday's elections in the U.S., ballot initiatives increasing the minimum wage passed in all six states. A ban on affirmative action that would make it more difficult for the government to recruit women and people of color for contracting education and employment passed in Michigan, likely leading to court challenges. Arizonans rejected a ban on same-sex marriage, while the ban passed in Colorado, South Dakota, Virginia, and Wisconsin with no more than 60% of the vote, and with wide margins in Idaho, Tennessee, and South Carolina. With Democrats winning control of the House of Representatives and awaiting the outcomes of the last unknown Senate seat in Virginia to determine if they will also control the Senate, Democrats on Capitol Hill are urging cooperation with the president on the Iraq war. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Displeasure with the war in Iraq was a top issue that drove voters to the polls and resulted in a Democratic victory on Tuesday. And Democratic leadership on Capitol Hill is holding Iraq as a top priority in the new Congress, which is to begin in January. Nancy Pelosi, the new likely Speaker of the House pending her colleagues' approval, promised to listen to the voters and change the policy in Iraq. To do that, she said she will work with the president.
It's important for us to work in a bipartisan way with the president, again, to solve the problem, not to stay the course. That's not working. That's clear.
As of airtime, the Democrats held 228 seats of the House of Representatives. Even with 11 seats still undecided, that is a clear majority that allows the Democrats the ability to set the legislative agenda on the floor and in the committees. And in the Senate, Democrats are awaiting the results of the Virginia race. The current tally has Allen down 6,000 votes. The votes are currently being re-canvassed to confirm the outcome, which could take up to 48 hours. The candidates will then have a right to call for a recount. But the leader of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, Senator Charles Schumer of New York, called on Republican George Allen to concede to his opponent, Democrat James Webb, to avoid a long recount.
To do the right and gentlemanly thing to do and just declare Jim Webb the winner now.
But members of the Senate Democratic leadership are all but sure they'll control the Senate. And they, too, spread a message of bipartisanship, especially on Iraq. Democratic leader Harry Reid of Nevada sent a letter to the president suggesting an Iraq leadership summit.
I hope the president will be willing to work with us.
A war cannot be legislated, so unless Congress chooses to cut funding, the only way for Democrats' ideas on Iraq to be implemented is to work with the commander-in-chief. And the president said at a news conference at the White House that he is willing to work with the Democrats.
See, if the goal is success, then we can work together. If the goal is get out now, regardless, then that's going to be hard to work together.
But that's where the differences remain. The president insists that the troops will stay until the job is done, and Democratic leader Pelosi says she wants to start pulling the troops out soon.
To send a clear message to the Iraqi government and people that they must disarm the militias, they must amend their constitution, they must engage in regional diplomacy to bring more stability and reconstruction to Iraq, and that we must begin the responsible redeployment of our troops outside of Iraq. We've said that over and over again.
Democratic Representative Ike Skelton of Missouri is to become chair of the House Armed Services Committee. He's ready to start reexamining the war. He said he'll reopen the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigation to investigate the handling of the Iraq War. The subcommittee was dissolved in 1994, the year the Republicans gained control of Congress.
In the past, the Congress has not worked and has not asked the tough questions or held the administration to account. That's my primary effort as chairman, to have the full committee look at comprehensive work toward the policy in Iraq.
Skelton also says he wants more attention and resources for the war in Afghanistan. With the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and new leadership in Congress, the direction of the war policy could very well change. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
As many as 42 Pakistani troops died in a suicide attack in the tribal region of Malakand in the Northwest Province. This comes on the heels of an aerial attack last week on an Islamic madrasa considered to be frequented by Afghan Taliban, in which some 83 innocent students died. The Islamist opposition in Pakistan says it believes that last week's attack was carried out by a U.S. Air Force across the border in Afghanistan. Masroor Hussain has more from Islamabad.
Pakistan Army joined the Bush's war on terrorism last year and killed hundreds of innocent people in the tribal region between Pakistan and neighboring Afghanistan. The innocent tribals who lost their lives were dubbed as Taliban or members of Al-Qaeda. Today's attack is the deadliest carried out against Pakistan's army by the tribal members. Professor Khalid Mahmood is a political analyst working for a think tank, and he believes that the terrorist network is still alive despite the 5 years war waged by Bush.
It is wrong to say that the Pakistan army has managed to break the terrorist network. Such an attack would have been carried out by a professional terrorist organization. This is only the beginning. I may be wrong, but I suppose this would not be an isolated incident. This is the end of the ceasefire, and the government should expect more of the same.
Waziristan peace accord was signed on September 5 this year between Musharraf's government and the Taliban. Under this accord, Taliban would cease violence on the Pakistani territory. The region where the Pakistan army came under attack is a stronghold of an Islamic fundamentalist organization, Tehreek-e-Hifaz-e-Shariat-e-Mohammadi, or Movement for the Enforcement of Islamic Law. One of its leaders ran the madrasa destroyed last week. He was killed in the attack. Mujtaba Shirazi is a political leader.
One thing is really very upsetting, that a proxy war is being fought over the land of Pakistan. Pakistan army is fighting Bush's agenda, and the other party, Osama's agenda. This war has nothing to do with Pakistan. Pakistani people are not party to it. But they are concerned that this fight is unnecessarily being fought over the land of Pakistan, and Pakistanis are being killed at both sides.
Yesterday, the governor of the province and architect of the recent peace accord in Waziristan also came under a rocket attack in the region while he was addressing a tribal gathering. Masroor Hussain, Free Speech Radio News, Islamabad.
A new study by a team of marine scientists outlined in the latest edition of Science magazine asserts a decline in marine biodiversity in the Earth's oceans. Overfishing, pollution, and other environmental factors will wipe out the global seafood supply by 2048. if steep declines in marine diversity continue at current rates. But as FSRN's Vinnie Lombardo reports, it's not too late to change the outcome and protect ocean wildlife.
The sea lions dwelling beneath the Santa Cruz Wharf are one of many thousands of species that populate the biologically rich waters of Monterey Bay. Normally a strict coastal creature, last year local sea lions traveled hundreds of miles offshore in search of edible fish, say marine researchers at UC Santa Cruz. This freakish behavior is one sign of a major shift in the ocean. A team of scientists from five countries conducted a study of marine biodiversity using regional ocean models and global fisheries data. Findings of their four-year study were published November 3rd in Science magazine. Their predictions paint a dark picture for the future of the world's fisheries. Marine diversity loss has already affected the stability of the ocean's ecosystems, they say, and if this trend continues, the global seafood market will run dry by 2048.
It's a scary scenario.
David Helvarg, president of Blue Frontier Campaign, points to the report's assertion that estuaries, coral reefs, wetlands, and oceanic fish are all rapidly losing populations, species, or entire groups.
There is a catastrophe in our oceans in terms of the loss of marine wildlife that's documented in this new science report, and we really could lose most of our edible species of wildlife and the diversity of the oceans by mid-century.
Helvarg says overfishing is a key part of the problem. Kate Wing, Oceans Policy Analyst with Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC.
For too long, a lot of these fisheries have been managed by the people who have a direct financial interest in them, the processors, the people who are making money off of them. Even though it's a public resource, the public hasn't been given a chance to have a say and say, hey, enough is enough.
Wing says seafood consumers are a driving force behind the drop in ocean life.
Fish is something special. It's not something you get to eat every day. And when you do eat it, you should make smart choices. There are a lot of guides on how you can eat smarter, support fishermen who are fishing in more sustainable ways.
15 years ago, the Santa Cruz Harbor had about 100 small and mid-sized commercial fishing boats docked there. Today, only half are left, while recreational crafts, such as whale-watching and sightseeing boats, have swelled in numbers. Many other cities report larger drops in commercial fishing vessels. Kevin Carney, who docks his small commercial crabbing boat at Santa Cruz Harbor, was dismissive of the findings in Science magazine.
I think it's sensationalism. It's just some scientists that decided, oh, we're going to make this huge claim that all the fish are going to be gone in 40 years. Well, they said that 40 years ago, that the fish were all going to be gone by now, but they're not.
Santa Cruz Port Director Brian Foss maintains the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which regulates West Coast commercial fishing, is effective.
You know, our fisheries basically are still healthy, and there are sustainable fisheries out there, albacore and salmon and crab. Yes, we've seen some species that are not as abundant as they were before, but those are under management plans, such as the rockfish, which has a complete moratorium commercially on it.
But Kate Wing of NRDC says most of the protections currently in place only look at one species.
In the ocean, everything is connected. So just by focusing on individual pieces, we're not focusing on what we call an ecosystem basis. Then we're really missing what's going on in the ocean, and that's part of what's caused the problems that we have today.
The Science magazine report cites other factors besides overfishing, which play a role in declining ocean wildlife. Coastal migration and associated development, offshore oil exploration, and global warming all contribute to marine species loss. However, the results also show that trends in declining sea life are still reversible if dramatic changes in ocean policy are enacted today. Reporting in Santa Cruz, Vinnie Lombardo, Free Speech Radio News.
Amidst the continuing political crisis in Oaxaca, Mexico's Interior Secretary has announced that Governor Ulises Ruiz has two options for his political future, to prove he can govern or to take a leave of absence. Anti-government demonstrations have become a daily occurrence in Oaxaca's capital. Yesterday, thousands of women dressed in black hit the streets to protest the dozens of illegal detentions that have occurred in the past 10 days. Meanwhile, Mexico's Senate has received a new legal petition calling for the dissolution of the government in Oaxaca. Vladimir Flores has the latest.
More than 3,000 women members of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca marched yesterday in Oaxaca City with the newly formed Committee of Relatives and Friends of Disappeared Persons and Political Prisoners of Oaxaca. They are demanding the withdrawal of the Federal Preventative Police and the release of the almost 90 people who have been detained since the arrival of federal police on October 29th. At yesterday's demonstration, women dressed in black faced down the federal police near the central square. Police used water cannons against the women who threw flowers and candles. Florina Jimenez Lucas is a public school teacher and the widow of Jose Jimenez Colmenares, who was gunned down on August 10th during a demonstration against the use of government repression.
No pido el esclarecimiento de esto porque sabemos de dónde vienen los golpes que nos han dado. ¿Sí? Sabemos.
I'm not asking for clarification because we already know where the strike against us has come from. We know why so many of our compañeros have fallen. We know why so many of our compañeros are in prison or disappeared. I'm making a call to all of the people and to the teachers to keep a ray of hope lit for our compañeros. Although my children and I and my husband's family no longer have any hope of seeing him again, there are compañeros for whom we must continue to fight.
Pero sí hay compañeros por los que debemos de luchar. Hay compañeros por los que debemos de continuar en esto.
Another motivation for yesterday's demonstration was to demand the release of the conflict's political prisoners, a sentiment expressed by this university student in reference to social activist Catarino Torres.
Tres meses ha cumplido el día de ayer que lleva recluido.
Monday marked 3 months since the beginning of his imprisonment in the maximum security prison in Mexico State. It's not right for the federal or state government to continue repressing all of us who have the strength to raise our voices. It's not possible that we allow them to keep disappearing and torturing our compañeros.
Que sigamos permitiendo, que siga desapareciendo y que siga torturando compañeros.
Meanwhile, in Mexico City, six representatives of Oaxaca's state legislature began a hunger strike in the interior of the Senate building after opposition parties submitted a measure to reconsider the dissolution of powers in Oaxaca. State Legislative Representative with the PRD party, Adriana Cruz Carrera, comments by phone on the reasons for these actions.
At 1 p.m. yesterday, as the Senate was in session, we began our hunger strike in the central patio of the Senate building, asking for the reconsideration of the measure to do away with the state government powers for the poor administration by Mr. Ulysses Ruiz. We need to stay here. We are going to keep resisting until we get a favorable response. This is an indefinite hunger strike. Never before has there been a hunger strike inside of the Senate. The pressure is now on them to make us leave.
The member organizations of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca will continue with their mobilizations in the midst of a tense climate caused by the presence of the federal police. Students are marching today to demand the university's autonomy be respected and an end to the interference of the signal of Radio Universidad, the main media outlet for the popular movement. In Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court heard two challenges, Gonzalez versus Carhart and Gonzalez versus Planned Parenthood, to the federal abortion ban, also known as the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003. These historic decisions could strike down the congressional ban as unconstitutional or criminalize what many experts say is the best and safest procedure for abortion care as early as 12 weeks of pregnancy. Nan McCurdy has more from the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court reviewed an almost identical case in 2000 of a Nebraska ban on the same procedure used in the second trimester called intact dilation and extraction, derogatorily referred to as partial birth abortion. Three appellate courts found the congressional ban unconstitutional based on the 2000 Supreme Court decision. Experts consider that the court agreed to revisit basically the same decision because of the change in the composition of the court. In the first case heard today, the Carhart case, Justice Kennedy asked Paul Clement, the lawyer representing the Department of Justice, and I quote, "Do we owe more to Congress than to a state legislature? If we owe deference to both, in the Nebraska case, despite that deference, the court found the state statute unconstitutional because it lacked an exception for the health of the mother. So if the evidence is about the same, how can we make a different decision here?" Jay Sekulow is the chief counsel for the American Center for Law and represents members of Congress in these cases.
At the end of the day, this case is going to be about, did Congress have the authority to ban this procedure? And I think a majority of the court's going to say, yes, they did. And I think it's going to be a deference to Congress issue as much as an abortion issue in this case.
All eyes were on Justice Kennedy, expected to be the pivotal vote to tip the balance between the four progressive and the four conservative judges, including Roberts and Alito, appointed by President Bush. Justice Alito never said a word during the proceedings. Eve Gardner gives her opinion of Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts, both considered conservatives.
Both of them expressed very serious concern about the fact that this law would take away from doctors and women a significantly safer abortion option.
At the beginning of the Carhart case, Justice Ginsburg asked the key question that pro-choice advocacy groups have been asking, quote, couldn't the congressional ban be used to eliminate D&E, the most common method for second trimester abortions? Dr. Leroy Carhart, chief plaintiff in the Carhart case.
What this is about is another attempt, another cog in the wheel to make all abortions illegal in the United States.
Ian Kelly, a pro-life protester leading a group in prayer in front of the Supreme Court, gave his opinion on this case.
If this was to be upheld, partial birth to be upheld by the court, it'd be a slap in the face to basically legislation. The president signed it. Congress passed it. Partial birth abortion should be stopped.
The Supreme Court will not hand down its decision on the federal abortion ban until next year. For Free Speech Radio News from the Supreme Court, I'm Nan McCurdy.
Nepal took a major step towards peace today when representatives of the government and Maoist rebels signed a deal that will, among other things, allow the Maoists to join the government in the near future. Nonetheless, Kathmandu also saw widespread protests throughout the day, with citizens accusing the Maoists of continuing strong-arm tactics. From Kathmandu, Carrie Byron has more.
Struck around 1:30 this morning, the new accord comes nearly 7 months after a popular uprising brought about the fall of Nepal's autocratic royal regime. The signing of the deal signifies the most official and binding pronouncement yet that the country's decade-long Maoist insurgency could be at an end. Senior journalist Kanakmani Dixit says that this morning's agreement now paves the way to real changes in the country through a constituent assembly currently slated for May or June.
Before that, what we had needed was the Maoists to join the government. Before the Maoists could join the government, they had to make a credible, scheduled commitment to putting down their arms. The agreement early this morning is exactly in that direction.
Despite a clear code of conduct agreement signed in June, Maoist extortions and other abuses have continued throughout negotiations. Given the timing of this week's rally, demonstrators are wondering whether anything will really change with this morning's agreement. Protester S.B. Gissing is tending a tire fire in the middle of one of Kathmandu's largest streets near the Maoist capital headquarters.
I don't think it made any changes. In the country, because all they want is they want to bring the peace process. But look at these people, who are difficult to feed themselves.
After a decade of suffering due to such Maoist lists, many in Nepal today are hoping that this morning's agreement will mean the end of guerrilla tactics and a start to a real campaign season. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Carrie Byron in Kathmandu.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. For archives of this or other newscasts, go to our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Ingrid Drake.